You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Welcome to the Lorehounds Podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to psycho history. I'm John.
And I'm Marilyn. This is our coverage of Foundation on Apple TV Plus, Season 3, Episode 8, Skin in the Game. If you want to get in contact with us, send an email, please, to empire@thelorehounds.com or head to our delightful Discord server from the link tree in the show notes below where you can talk to some really lovely people.
You can also, if you want to support us, get early ad-free bonus content. Not early on this because it's, you know, screeners where we have an embargo. By the way, I put it out as early as I can legally. Like, they give us a time we can put it out. So that's the earliest I could possibly put it out.
Yes.
Anyway, check the link tree in the show notes again for our Patreon and Supercast subscriptions. All right, Marilyn, what did you think of Season 3, Episode 8 of Foundation?
We just keep getting layer on layer on layer, some really fascinating bits and pieces. And new questions keep rising. You know, you think something is resolved and then suddenly, whoops, no, something new pops up. The visuals are stunning. I mean, there was a whole chunk of this that was very deliberately theatrical, but they just went over the top. They were practically chewing the scenery. It was a lot of fun. Just a lot of fun.
I have some things to say about that too. Some positive, some not quite as positive.
I thought you might. I just kind of, you know, I sat there with the popcorn and had fun.
I had to grab my bowl of cereal for a little bit on this episode.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. But it was resonating in a lot of tones that are definitely in my wheelhouse, if I can mix my metaphors horribly.
Fair enough.
And I love the way that they're approaching these concepts that would show up in both science fiction and fantasy literature, such as this whole question of mental and emotional control of others. Because there's crossover there and possibilities for comparison. And as I alluded to, there's a very strong dip into the world of ritual, which, as people will know, I'm interested in.
Right, interpretive dance specifically.
That's part of it, yes. Though I will honestly say, I know that sci-fi people might not really appreciate it too much.
I didn't have as much of a problem with that. More like, how much time did they have to prepare this? Because it seemed like they were incorporating some things that they just learned into the dance. And I was like, I just feel like this is a very working class neighborhood, right? Like, how much spare time do we have to go rehearsing the interpretive dance underground?
Well, remember, he is very careful to point out that nobody rules over anybody and nobody is, you know, existing only to serve other people, yada, yada. So,
yeah.
There may be a whole union of interpretive dancers that is out there.
The Interpretive Dance Guild. Okay.
The Interpretive Dance Guild.
The Dancing Dominion, like the Cloud Dominion. You never know.
Something like that. Because clearly these kinds of spiritual, mystical, religious concepts are very important to the people of Mycogen. So, you know, why not have a class of interpretive dancers and theatrical whatevers? But, you know, we don't know how long it was between the last time Day lost consciousness and they gathered together their forces. But anyway, one other thing I noticed, I invite people to take a close look at the opening credits yet again. And the statue putting its right fingers on its left forearm. It really caught my attention this time because of the hairstyle of the clearly feminine figure. I'm really convinced that this is Songbird 17.
Yeah, I think you're right. Cool. I think you're right. I was looking at it once you said that, and I was like, okay, all right.
Okay.
I think I'm with you.
All righty. Well, cool. I'm always glad when you're with me, John. So what did you find?
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good episode. It certainly wasn't wowing me in basically any part. I was a little eye-rolly when we had the mule in the air going, oh, I was like, all right, I didn't quite need that shot for that long. It was a little...
I suppose the length was a little over the top.
But. It was a little much, and I was like, I kind of don't buy that Harry is this smug in this moment when he literally had to ghost the foundation because he didn't know what to do about the mule.
Well, you know, he learns pretty quickly, this Harry.
Yeah. And,
you know, with a vault holographic mind processor, whatever, wouldn't take him too long. But I enjoyed that scene very much, except what I didn't need was all the blood trickling from his nose and his mouth and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think all that whole scene, it was a little over the top for me. I continue to be a little bit eye-rolly at the Death Star that is brewing.
I know.
I'm not quite a fan of that. Basically, this episode kind of had all of my least favorite parts of the season.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense.
And that doesn't mean that I don't think that the show is going to wrap up in a really satisfying way. Like, I still think we're going right towards a really good finale.
Sure.
But this really was not my episode.
Sure.
Even Demerzel didn't really get a chance to shine much other than the scene with, I know the orchard was a bit of a scene, but I thought that it was so short compared to the rest of the episode. I thought we focused on all the things that I care for less this season.
Yeah. Well, she had shorter moments this time. It's certainly true, but
yeah.
Every single one of them, I think, was worth their weight. And hopefully people don't feel that we're spoiling too many things here, because I don't know how non-spoiler this first part is supposed to be.
Oh, no, we're always full spoiler from the beginning of this episode.
Okay, all right. Just
particular episode. Of course, nothing future in the books or in the show.
No.
We haven't even watched further in the show, so that's
all. No, we have not. We have not.
But we're okay. We're okay.
Okay.
I think by now they know that we spoil everything in the hot takes from the episode.
I hope so.
If not, sorry. That's what we do. Anyway, my point is, I did really like, like I mentioned, the scene in the orchard. I did really like that, although it left me a little confused. I'm not really sure what's going to happen there.
Me too.
And that's sort of what I mean, right? Is that the parts that I did like were kind of left a little open-ended and a little vague.
Well, they're doing a lot of open-endedness, aren't they?
Yeah. Also,
one of those open-endeds was finally resolved, though, and I was very proud of myself for that.
we'll get to that, I think.
You're talking about Dawn? Yes, I am.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is, I'm going to say this for Alicia's sake, this is my least favorite kind of cliffhanger, is he's literally dropping off the cliff. At the end, Day just falling down the chute and not quite being there. Anyway, I don't want to be too negative, because like I still enjoyed the episode. Like I'm not tuning out, and I'm really looking forward to the next episode.
Oh yeah, it just
was a lot of setup for me. Mm-hmm. Avengers Assemble kind of thing with the Gale crew, and I think we're just kind of we were kind of treading water on a lot of plot lines this episode.
Setting the stage. Again,
and you need to do that, right? Like that is a necessary thing, and yet it's never going to be the episode you remember. Like, this is not going to be an episode that goes down in like the great foundation episodes, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, you need episodes like that.
You're going to remember the shocking climaxes and the really beautifully realized scenes and the deeply emotional parts and all that sort of thing.
And 2 points off for mentioning Salver Hardin, my least favorite character in the whole show.
Oh, go on.
I'm mostly joking.
Let us. I know you are. I know you are, because you're not one to let your biases overrule your just evaluation of.
Truly, everyone knows I am fairer than anyone. No, I could be Empire. No,
you are just, John. You are just, and if you're not being just, then you admit it right up front.
I try to. I try to. I keep my hot takes very obvious.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, enough of my hot takes. Again, I don't want to bring us down here because I did really like, I do still really like the show. And I thought this was a really good setup episode.
I think we get that.
Let's get set up here. Let's Harry and the Mule. Harry continues to doubt the veracity of the Mule's backstory on Rossum. The Mule tries to intimidate the psycho historian, but is promptly lifted into the air and almost killed before Harry releases him. Harry says once he finds out the Mule's secret, the Mule may be of use to him. The Mule returns to Scarlet and shows her Gale's facial beads and tells her he will have her soon.
Yeah, so there was one checkoff right there. You know, people wondered what was in Gale's pouch, and now it is revealed. So, five points to the houses of all the people who guessed that.
Yeah, the facial beads. Super fun.
Yeah.
Nice callback.
Exactly. So, the great convo continues between Harry and the Viking Mule. And there are little bits and pieces that are thrown in here that's useful to me. Like, it's been 300 years since he died. And so he also says he's never dictated to the Foundation, so he personally should not be held responsible for any of its oppressive actions when the Mule is there trying to be judge, jury, and executioner on him.
I don't buy that, by the way. If what happened to the Mule is true, this plan is like Harry shouldn't accept some level of responsibility for the suffering that the Foundation causes, because it's his plan. Even if the first foundation is not quite aware of it, this is the intention, right? This is the plan, is to have it go through a tyrannical stage.
Well, authoritarian at any rate.
Sure.
And
what do autocracies usually do? They usually batter down the little people. And I'm not saying that it's not for quote unquote the greater good in the end, but I don't think he can skirt responsibility for what happens either. The Foundation doesn't exist without him, right?
Certainly.
And this phase of Foundation also does not exist without him.
I suppose one could ask the same question. Are you going to feel responsible for the behavior of your children when they're in their 30s and 40s and 50s?
I mean, if I told them what they needed to do, or if I at least predicted out what they needed to do, and I set up a second group of people that were making sure that they kept doing what I wanted them to do, then yes, I would still be responsible.
And you would never do any of those things.
But you get what I'm saying? Is like, it's not equivalent what you're saying here.
I understand. Yes. Well, and then we
always had their cousins make sure that they stayed on my path, right?
It's always comforting if we can blame someone personally instead of, institutions or whatever, although that's a different kind of cop-out. But
sure, anyway. But I just mean, like, I don't think that, I don't really buy Harry's don't look at me, I have nothing to do with this. Like, dude, you have a lot to do with it.
He set things up initially in a certain way, and I think we have to be careful that predicting that something will happen is not the same thing as causing it to happen. And again,
we do have this second foundation. Yeah. We do have a very carefully picked set of people who move into the first foundation, right? Like, this is, again, that he did poke history with a large group of people to try to nudge them in the right direction.
Yep. Yeah, and it was interesting that they get into this whole contest about who suffered more in their childhood years. Because,
yeah, that's always helpful.
Yeah, he explained that he also experienced what it was like when the resources that his planet was providing to the Empire were less than the quota. So he maybe is trying to relate to the Mule on some level. But then he also says things like, gloating is soft sand. And not the reason why you came. Mm-hmm. So again, he's going down two or three layers and, okay, get the emotional steam blown. And then now let's get down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
Tell me why you're really here. What I found interesting is that he actually says if the Mule took over, he would hasten the path to a better future.
Well, I think if you pressed Harry more, first of all, I think Harry knows that whatever he says here, the mule is going to do what the mule is going to do.
Of course.
And the second part is, it's possible that the mule unites the galaxy for a while.
In opposition to him.
Sure. But does that mean that he can sustain an empire? Because that's something that you see with a lot of revolutions is, sure, you can overthrow the government.
That's right.
But can you run your own government? Because those are two different sets of skills.
Well, and I think that maybe one of Harry's subtext messages is no empire lasts forever.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
So maybe that's another reason why he's saying, I'm not personally responsible here. This is part of large forces that no one person can possibly direct with any kind of assurance. Because it's still mathematical predictions. And you can go to 99.99%. That doesn't mean, I know it's interesting. I wonder if there were ever 100% certainty prediction in any of the psychohistory stuff.
Hmm.
So, but, you know, as you say, the mule's going to do what the mule's going to do. And he uses his usual go-to, which is to reach out with his mind powers. And again, Harry gets the wonderful lines, look at you fumbling away in the dark, trying to find my mind. But he doesn't have feelings, and so the mule's attempts don't work. So that's an interesting thing. Seems to be mule can only get to thoughts through feelings.
I think that's probably part of it, but also we knew that Gale couldn't get through to Demerzel, so we knew that the robots were immune to these mentalic powers, and seems to be true also with whatever Harry is, whatever Vault Harry is.
Yep.
I know there's been some question as to how different are Vault Harry and Demerzel. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah. And yet there seems to be the possibility of at least Harry reading the mule's mind.
I think he's just smart. I think that was just
mental calculation.
As soon as the mule put on his like try hard face, he's like, you're trying to get in my head.
Well, and they give the impression that, you know, as a vault holograph, he can read vibrations. I mean, he knew instantly that Demerzel wasn't human, for example. So he can feel whatever it is that is the effect of the mule reaching out to trying to, you know, probe his secrets. And yet it was Harry who says to him, you have a secret. And once I know what it is, you may be of use to me.
Mm.
And I suspect that both you and I have a notion of what that secret might be.
I think so, although this episode made me doubt it a little bit, but not fully.
Okay.
Not fully. We can maybe discuss after the credits for a minute.
Sure. And it's interesting that he could kill the mule, but he doesn't. He chooses not to. So even though he had not predicted the mule and didn't know what the mule was when they first started telling him about, you know, say, what about the mule? And he's like, what's the mule?
Right.
He must have done a real quick study or caught up on the, speed listened to recent broadcasts of galactic news or whatever. And figured out.
Get me my radio.
Yeah, really? How come nobody showed me these headlines?
Well, maybe he should stop only poking his head out every 50 years or so.
Well, closer to 100 years. Right? Yeah, 100, 150. Yeah. It's long stretches. It takes people time to tear down one form of government and build up another one, you know?
Right.
It's not.
Unless you're the mule. It doesn't take very, very much time to tear down a form of government then.
Well, if you want it to last.
We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see what he does. What do you think about his conversation with Scarlet?
I find it interesting that he refers to Gale as the girl from the water planet.
Mm-hmm.
This dude really has an obsession with water. all the drownings that we talked about in the previous episode of our podcast.
Also, he is the actor who played Euron Greyjoy in Game of Thrones, and I don't know how much you know about that world.
Was he one who was drowned?
He was the drowned king. You have to survive a drowning, become That's king in right. the Iron Isles.
That's right. I vaguely remember bits and pieces. So that is kind of an ironic casting.
They prayed to the drowned god. Yeah,
but he certainly seems to be able to handle this part. One wonders what Scarlet is supposed to do with these little stones. They're not set in anything in particular. She can't eat them.
I thought he took them back.
Oh, did he take them back?
I think he took them back at the end and put them back in the pouch.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. Then he swapped it out for a candy. Remember?
Yeah. So why did he show them to her in the first place?
I think he just uses her for the exposition.
Yes. Eat your cereal, Marilyn.
Yeah. This is just an exposition dump. All right, let's go to Dusk and Demerzel.
Let's.
Dusk mourns his brother Don with Quent, who reaffirms his individuality. Presider Kin from the Galactic Council arrives with Zephyr Varelis and Enjoiner Beryl from the Cloud Dominion to give Dusk a polite notice that they will be proffering Krantor to the Mule as an act of appeasement. Dusk and Demerzel refuse to accept it, and Dusk finally reveals the Navacula. That's right. It's amazing that Tarkin was able to make two of these. Three of them. No, two of them, because he wasn't around for the second Death Star.
Right. Once you have the blueprints, you know.
Yeah. It's really all logistics and supply chains from there.
Well, basically, yeah. Even though your archive copy of the blueprints was stolen. I mean, it's got to be available in other servers and other. I mean, how could, as we know, the sort of bottom line nowadays is the minute you put anything online, somebody can find it somehow if they really want to. So
that's true.
Maybe they have resolved that particular quandary long ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Star Wars jokes aside, I think we've got a lot to get through here. I think it was really interesting to watch Quent bring in the Foundation philosophy. It felt very much like speaking to a group of Christians who are debating predestination versus free will, right? It almost felt like Tolkien's idea of the universe of like, hey, individuals can't affect the grand plan, but it matters what the individual does to that individual and to their, you know, their close by individuals.
Right.
It felt very Tolkien to me, this whole exposition on the Foundation philosophy.
Yeah, I think that's a good catch. And I think there is a sense in which Tolkien might express it as, you know, there is a plan and individuals are required to carry out that plan.
Mm-hmm.
And if one individual fails to carry it out, then another one will eventually come along to take their place.
Sure. You know, I just mean that, like, you're not going to stop the grand plan. The grand plan by deviating from it, but you may change your own outcome and you may change the outcomes of those around you.
Well, and that's pretty much what Quint says, isn't
right,
it?
Right. Right.
A person is a person. I was raised to believe that individuals can't affect the future, but I know we affect each other. And
she went really Dr. Seuss about it, right? A person's a person, no matter how small.
Yeah, there's a lot of reference to other writings in this particular episode. I've mentioned one or two, I think, down below. Yeah, so prior to this, of course, Demerzel had confirmed to Dusk that Don is dead, though I still didn't believe it. And I love Dusk's reflection that we're supposed to be interchangeable and it just isn't true anymore. And she responds, I doubt it ever was.
Right.
Which kind of tracks along with what I was saying before about as soon as you assign a number
mm-hmm.
to a reign, you are distinguishing.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later, people will, you know, people's reactions to you, as well as your own thoughts about your whole situation, you're going to start individuating.
Right.
So
the conciliator, right? He had his own moniker already.
Right. And yet, when, you know, three other factions within the galaxy come and say, we want to conciliate.
Yeah. I do really like that they use it against him, right? This ambush of leaders comes in and ambushes him and says, well, you were a conciliator. Conciliate.
Yeah. And ambush is a very good word for it. I mean, again, talk about the fall of the power of the Triple Throne. And they even say, you know, the middle throne is empty.
Right.
So who are you to say, you know, Empire, and you're going to be dusted in 3 days.
I know. And Demerzel's so like, disgusting. I got such a busy week ahead of me. I got to decant two new Cleons.
Yeah.
I didn't write it into the summary, but yeah, that was one of the things. That was why Dusk showed Demerzel the Navacula, right? He's like, we don't have time to decant a new dawn and day. We need a weapon right now.
And, oh, by the way, he was astounded that she hadn't already known about it.
I really liked that. I really liked that he genuinely thought there's no way she doesn't know about this.
Which, again, reveals both the power of her image in the minds of Empire.
Right.
But it also reveals that, yeah, even Demerzel is not all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful.
Right.
So it was a very interesting moment. I think Demerzel may feel some betrayal that her counselor thinks that this is a good solution. And that, in fact, it was the Luminists coming in on it that swayed the decision for the the other two folks and so on and so on. And, you know, I got to say, Varelis's moral philosophy that she cites as, you know, justification, death basically boils down to the good of the many weighs over the good of the few. And I'm thinking, yeah, thank you, Mr. Spock. You know, it's an interesting philosophy and, again, can be used to justify any manner of behavior. So,
right.
I'm not sure you can claim moral purity for it. Philosophically, it makes sense, but then you get into a whole other category of discussion, don't
you? We know appeasement has always worked.
Well, yeah.
I was sarcasm,
folks. Talk to the British.
It didn't work. I know Chamberlain would like to have a word with me.
And yet, you know, it's true when Varelis says to Quint, you know, Quint breaks in and says, look, you can't appease this guy. His appetite is insatiable. And Quint says, but the Foundation has done it for hundreds of years now, and it's brought prosperity and so on. Another example of the way in which the mule is an outlier. He's a sport. He's a completely unpredictable quantity. And so all of the previous ways of working aren't going to work much anymore. And in a sense, that's true of any society as it moves along. You know, new ages bring new problems. And even when you think you've solved things, there's going to continue to be complications. So the notion that you can solve everything once and for all is, anytime anybody is trying to sell that, I smile politely and look for the nearest exit because I just don't see it. I just don't see it.
Yeah.
It is kind of poignant that he started work on the Navacula the minute he became Dusk and intended it as a gift for Dawn when he ascends to the middle throne, because he immediately thought, you know, the present day is just not worth anything. And I've got to do something to help the current Dawn, who will eventually be Day, and give him something that will kind of re-solidify whatever power has been slipping away. Because the middle throne is basically checked out.
Brother Dude. Have you seen that? That's what people are calling him on Reddit?
It doesn't Brother surprise Dude me.
Instead yeah, of Brother no. Day. I'm sense. Enjoying it.
That makes sense. Yeah. And he's really crushed when Demerzel tells him that Dawn has become an ally with Gale on the Second Foundation.
Yeah. And you could tell he also doesn't fully believe her. He's like, I mean, he kind of questions it himself, but I think he's like, there's more to the story there. And there is more to the story, right? Like
there is definitely more to the story.
He's not against Empire. He is just pro-human life.
Yeah. And when he says to her, it's just us now, Demerzel. Our legacy is being ripped from our hands. We must not let it go. There's a beautiful, gentle statement of the Empire theme there, which to me brings more the poignancy to the whole situation. And all of the existential questions, you know, if Empire goes away, what happens to Demerzel? And so on.
And music is going to tie us to Demerzel's fate later. I mean, that's a great use of music here, right?
Absolutely.
Which I will say, you called that in a previous episode. It might have been last episode.
I did.
Why does she know that melody?
I did. Because I recognized they had given it to us in that same episode.
Right.
From Day's childhood memories. And I said, that's the same melody. So what's...
Right. Any other thoughts on this set of scenes?
I think that's it. Let's talk about the orchard.
Let's go to the orchard. But first...
But not Chekhov.
Okay, not Chekhov's... Orchard. Not Chekhov's orchard. Let's take a quick break before we figure out what metaphor we're mixing.
Okay.
Welcome back, and we're ready to talk about the orchard. Demerzel meets one more time, probably, with Zephyr Varelis, who offers her sanctuary with the Luminists. Demerzel refuses removing her Luminous bracelet and lamenting what she must do to another Luminous priestess. And I say another, not in addition to Zephyr Varelis, I phrase that a little poorly, but she had to do something to some Luminous priestess in the past. She doesn't want to do it again. That's what she's saying.
Right, right. That was back in season two. And it's very, I don't know. I thought at first it meant, all right, the death is going to happen off stage or whatever, which maybe it still will. I don't know.
I thought it was going to happen right there. I mean, I thought.
I did too. And I think Varelis did too.
Yeah. And I kind of.
The first thing she says, you're going to feed me one of your poison apples. And Demerzel assures her that she is not even considering feeding her one of them.
But I mean, Varelis, I mean, she doesn't even fight back. And I like that in the world building, because what would she do, right? She can't fight off a robot. If that robot decides she's going to die, she's going to die.
But does Varelis know that Demerzel is a robot? Oh, that's right.
Demerzel at that moment, yes, because she's in her memory.
In the context of the orchard.
Right.
She knows that outside the orchard. Who knows?
Right.
Whether or not she would even, again, would she even try to fight off? It doesn't seem to me as though that would be sort of the path.
It's undignified. Who knows?
Well, it's for a priestess. But I think there's other things too. I found it really sad and moving and almost shocking when Demerzel takes her bracelet off. It just, it was, because that we've seen in previous seasons.
And it seemed like such a core part of her personality.
Right. She'll actually, in difficult times, she holds the salt crystal that's hanging from that bracelet. And she had initially brought in Varelis because she was feeling what we could call a religious crisis or a spiritual crisis, of which is largely, more largely, an existential crisis of who am I if there's no more empire? But evidently, none of Varelis's responses, assurances, etc., were sufficient for her, because, as she rather dramatically states the previous episode, I'm not human. So all the things you're saying just don't apply to me. So, I don't know. It's just very sad. And this time I realized that there's all these women going around holding their arms in specific positions. I talked about the two fingers on the arm that Songbird showed us. Varelis is always walking around with her right hand clasped over her left wrist, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And Demerzel
has her... Is she holding her bracelet? Is there a bracelet that she's wearing and holding?
I don't think she has bracelets. I just think she's holding the left wrist. And then Demerzel, of course, is famous for always having her hands in the same position, you know, over her diaphragm kind of thing. Like she said, it's
a marionette.
Instructional
almost, right?
Session. I was going to say an instructional session for singing, you know, place your hands on your diaphragm.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And fill up your diaphragm. Yeah.
You feel your diaphragm moving up and down.
Yeah.
But interesting that Varelis tells her, the Luminists are not passive players in this. We have power. Now, is it the power of a religion that has tens of millions of followers throughout the galaxy? One has never had the impression that this is a warlike religion.
No.
But, you know, I wondered what she might have been thinking about there. And again, so sad. Demerzel says, I've enjoyed our time together almost like friendship. I was foolish to think the mother could hold me in her arms. So where are these desires coming from in a positronic brain?
Well, if all right, so now we know it's Daniil, right? And I will tell you that Daniil in the books, in the robot books, because I've read a couple of books with Daniil in it.
Right.
He was made specifically by the spacers to fit in with Earthlings, to feel Earth feelings and to be able to, you know, have Earth reactions, to not be, and I guess this has been let go of by this time, maybe in the books. I haven't read this part in the books, but definitely in the show, you know, similar strengths to humans, similar everything to humans, just to fit in more, right? To not accidentally, like, not blink or something like that, right?
Right.
And
right,
so I do think that if you design a robot like that, you know, what's more human than believing in something?
Sure.
You know?
Or feeling grief that you can't have what you want.
Right.
Now, there's one more power I'm thinking of now that Daniil was posited with. And if you feel this is too spoilery, we'll just go ahead and edit it out.
Yeah, I do think that particular thing is, okay, I know what you're going to say from last time. I think we did it after the credits. I don't think we could talk about any of Daniil's stuff from the Foundation books, really.
Okay, well, maybe I can bring it up again today after the...
Yeah, let's talk about it after the credits. Yeah. But I just wanted to bring in some of like the deep past from the robot books, which may not even be true with this because we're so far from the books at this point. I mean, well, Daniil was a male robot, right? Like, and clearly the plot lines don't work the same way with a male robot. And I'm glad that they made Daniil Demerzel a female robot in the show, because I think it tells a different story.
Yes. Oh, unquestionably. And brings in a lot of other things like Luminism and the mother and all that sort of thing. And, you know, Demerzel calls herself the Empire's Pale Reaper, and nothing can change that. Well, doesn't that sound like the pronouncement of a death sentence?
Yeah.
And Varela certainly looks as though she thinks that it's a death sentence when she...
It's like, man, I put my foot in it again.
That truth-telling stuff, you know, it's really rough sometimes. But then we see her walking through that sort of path with the floating, humming computer balls. And she comes out the other side of a corridor of him and then asks Lady Demerzel why she'd been crying. So, I don't know. Didn't look terribly deadly to me in that particular time. She seems to remember who she is and who Demerzel is and all these other things, just not what happened in the garden. Well, of course, we know from season 2 that Demerzel could already have poisoned her when she touched her. So, you know, hard to say.
Yep. Who knows?
Hard to say.
I don't think they're going to pull the same move, though. I don't think they're going to pull the same thing.
It would be disappointing if they did, quite frankly. But it seems to be falling in line with the fact, for example, that instead of killing Songbird, she just wiped her memories and sent her back to Mycogen. So maybe wipe the Vralis' memories and send her back to you know, the Maiden. I don't know if the Luminists currently on Trantor are going to like that very much, not to mention the 10 million throughout the galaxy. You know, one problem at a time, right?
Yep. That's probably true. They're not going to like any of their people being messed with.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's talk about the captives.
Let's.
Dawn awakens injured and captive with Beta. He floated for days outside Clarion Station, and his suit consumed parts of his legs to maintain life support until the Mule Scouts found him. The Mule arrives and tries to learn the location of the Second Foundation. Upon learning that Dawn doesn't know, he begins to torture Dawn until Beta intercedes, telling him it's time to leave. The Mule agrees as Gale Dornick has arrived.
Huzzah and 3 million loud cheers. I thought that Dawn still had to be alive. It just...
Oh, yeah. I you know, we're in the stage of television where no body, no death. That's
right,
kind of where
I'm at. That has been brought up a number of times, and I think in this instance it wasn't quite as clear. I mean, I think some people's faith was shaken by the fact that Demerzel herself believed that Dawn was dead, and it is kind of interesting. Again, is this one more slip on her part? And they brought him to New Terminus and put him in the same sick bay as Beta, who was more or less recovered from her encounter with the Nullfield. All of her faculties are more or less intact, although it still hurts her to think too much, which is, you know, sad. And can I just say the thought of surviving by cannibalizing your own legs is just gross, even if you're not doing it yourself. But it reminds me of 19th century stories of explorers being trapped somewhere and drawing lots to see whose leg they're going to eat. Shades of the Donner Pass.
I was just going to say the Donner Party.
Donner Pass and some pretty horrific 19th century English war stories. So it's, you know, it's not unheard of, but
there's a very good episode of podcast called You're Wrong About the Donner Party.
Sure.
And I would recommend that if people want to know more about that. That was a group of I think it was 19th century explorers, yes, who
late 1800s.
Yeah. Who tried to get to California. They didn't do too well.
Yeah. It was unpleasant. I actually had there was an earlier book about it all. Our fifth grade teacher would read chapters of this to us after lunch.
About the Donner Party?
Yes.
Why?
Because she hadn't read it herself, which
I knew there was a reason the boomers were the way they were.
It's cemented forever in my mind the idea that I will not offer or share any book with anybody under the age of 21 unless I've read it myself first and know that it's appropriate. God. Yeah, well, it didn't scar me for life or anything, but wow, I certainly remember all about the Donner Party.
Okay, remind me, I want to talk about the scene after the credits, because I think there is a massive clue in it.
I do too.
But we can't do that yet. So
no, we can't.
For now, I just want to say, I don't know how many people have to flirt with Dawn, but I guess Dawn is in a polycule of sorts. No, but Beta's just being friendly, and I get that.
Of course she is.
And I like that we find out that she and Torin are an act. I don't think we knew that before.
Well, an act, I think, is a metaphor for, we look familiar to you because you've seen us on the whatever their equivalent of, you know.
TikTok I thought that they do like a formal act as entertainers around.
Oh, no, I think they are real. They're the, you know, the
socialites
version of influencers.
Okay. All right.
Influencers and socialites. That's how I read it anyway.
Have you seen my TikTok channel?
I don't TikTok. You know,
I'm saying that's what Beta's saying.
Just in general, yeah, right?
That's Beta's.
Right. Haven't you seen this on TikTok?
Yeah.
Of course, that's how you recognize me.
Yeah.
I love the mule's line. My mind is like a biscuit. I enter other minds and sop up all they know. And then later on, he tries to sop up from Dawn and asks if Gale is a secret planet, and Dawn answers, if you know, then sop it up.
Right. If I know, come and get it, you know?
Seriously.
Daring him, and I don't even think the mule tries after that. He's like, huh, you don't know.
Right, he just says, all right, clearly you don't know.
Right. I'll just get it from Gale directly.
Well, but he also says Gale takes up a lot of space in Dawn's head, and Dawn responds, sounds like you know what that's like. I mean, talk about smackdown and burn. I mean,
there was a lot of good verbal sparring here.
He gives better than he gets, at least this exchange.
A lot of good verbal sparring.
Yeah, there's something about being, you know, part of Empire, you know, part of the Triple Throne.
That just
gives you this kind of chutzpah in these sorts of situations.
Well, you do spend all day arguing with yourself, right?
It's a whole new concept around having an argument with yourself.
That's right.
Indeed.
That's right.
And then Beta telling the mule, I think you should leave now. And he does.
Mm-hmm.
Although he says, Gale's just arrived, so yeah, you're right.
But it was an odd turn, wasn't it?
It was an odd turn.
It was a very sudden and odd turn.
And the mule does not kick Beta into next week.
No.
Right? So, you know.
You would think he would make her drown herself or something.
Exactly. Or tear off the bandages there's no bandages on Dawn's legs. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, she looks like she made a great recovery from where she was last week.
She did pretty well. Yeah. She did pretty well.
She seems second, pretty up and at 'em.
The first foundation medical practices must be very advanced.
Yeah, you see the way that she alludes to that, right? Dawn's like, oh, I'm so injured. She's like, they got all the kinds of stuff for that now. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. They'll fix you up.
It's like it's like that Harry Potter potion to regrow your bones, right? Or something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I think the foundation has all the tech. If you're getting sick, I think that's where you want to be.
That's the place to go to solve all of these seemingly intractable chronic conditions.
Well, the mule is ready to meet Gale, so let's catch up with her.
We got to catch up with Gale.
On Ignis, Gale convinces Preem to lead the Second Foundation to a new planet, which not even she will know the location of. After arguing, he agrees to do so and gives her his blessing to fight the mule, but not without help. Gale and her X-Men arrive on New Terminus to begin their confrontation.
X-Men and women.
Well, I'm just going with the classic X-Men. She can be Professor X too. Charles Xavier. Okay.
I love that Preem takes on basically what all the bishops are supposed to take on before they're consecrated is, I do not want to be a bishop. I do not want to be a leader. And of course, the general knowledge that probably the best leaders are the ones who don't want to be leaders. Although that's a little shaky sometimes.
I think that's a biblical, that is a Western biblical trope, right? That is something, it starts with Moses, keeps going throughout the whole Bible.
Okay.
And that is,
good point.
I think that's the root of that, is the reluctant leader starts with Moses.
I think there was an emperor sometime during the Roman Empire that said, I don't want to be emperor, but they all said, well, you got to be because, you know, family line or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he turned out to be one of the best. And then, of course, there was another emperor who actually retired and said, okay, I've given enough to the empire. I am now retiring to my garden. I'm Tacitus, I think it was. Or maybe it wasn't Tacitus.
Jimmy Carter of him, right?
Those of you who know your Roman history, please write and tell me which emperor it was that retired and had a happy rest of the life.
It was Emperor Carter, I'm telling you. Emperor Jimmy Carter doing his Habitat for Humanity every year, basically till he died.
If you say so.
He really did that, Jimmy Carter.
Oh, I know. I don't think he would have characterized it as his empire. That just doesn't sound like Jimmy Carter.
The guy sold his peanut farm to be less conflicted. I mean, come on.
Yeah, he did. He did. I lived through that presidency, John, so I'm...
Well, I recently read a book about it, so.
Well, good.
So it's I think good I win.
To keep up with history.
Kidding. I'm just kidding. All right. So.
Yeah, Gale's line. This is not suicide if I kill him first.
I don't know if you got it there. This whole scene was a little. All right, we got to get the gear. We got to get the team. We got to get to a new location.
Yeah, I know.
Not my favorite kind of storytelling, but. You know, we're doing it and we're getting to the next step. So let's just get there.
Well, and besides, you hear Gale talking to the statue of Harry, which Harry himself sculpted. And
yeah, but then I have to hear Salver Hardin nonsense.
Oh, stop.
Salver was supposed to be here. No, she wasn't.
According to the original plan, Raish was supposed to be there and Gale wasn't even supposed to.
That's true.
Ever come along. So, you know, let's not look backwards and trying to get move forwards.
Well, you also have to remember that Salver was supposed to survive until the mule battle and then die during that.
Exactly.
And that is what Salver said proves she can change the future. So right. That I think that may be more meaningful than I'm giving it credit for with my sardonic nature.
I think that is absolutely true, John. So Salver died in order to ensure Gale that future is malleable. Even though she seems to have forgotten that now. I mean, mostly right now, she's completely tracked on the fact that anytime she tries to get beyond that point in the future, there is nothing. And, you know, the whole, from previous episode, you know, she's circling around the black hole.
Doesn't seem to be a fun vacation spot around the black hole.
Yeah, I can think of other places I'd rather be.
Yeah.
And I like Preem emphasizing the importance of the fact that Gale is coming from a community. People who walk so much in each other's thoughts that we're like one creature. I like that. You know, that image, so that even though, yes, you think you're going alone, but we're all with you. And oh, by the way, a couple of us are going with you physically as well as, you know, mentally and whatever.
Yeah, I do think that that's true. And it's a powerful message of, you know, the people who try to enforce their will on everybody are in the end weaker than those who have the big tent, right? Who want to have community and want to have relationship. And, you know, it's, again, bring back the Tolkien, you know, the Fellowship of the Ring was stronger than the one guy who couldn't imagine that people would work together to destroy it, right? Couldn't imagine that nobody would try to claim it. I guess somebody did try to claim it in the end, but his finger got bit off, so it was fine.
Well, and somebody else, you know, lost their life, and another one lost his life defending
you get
a whole
my
bunch
point,
of the
though,
people.
Right?
So,
I, like,
of course.
Sure,
of
no course. One person could have destroyed the ring.
That's
but
Tolkien's
that's the,
point,
but
exactly.
But the point is the Fellowship is what saved them.
It is.
And pity
and
mercy, right?
And the redemption for the one who had to have his finger bit off was that he had done everything he could possibly do as an individual to come to that point. And then after that, it was up to other forces to, as one of my Tolkien friends says, put the divine banana peel under Gollum's foot so that he slipped at the right moment.
what do you think was the first thing that, like, I don't know, like, Isildur said to Gollum when he got to Eru Heaven, you know? He's like, hey, buddy, how did the ring treat you, Smeagol?
Yeah, you know, I guess we both kind of had the same problem there, but we were both dealing with the same ring, so it makes sense.
We should get a little comedy going on the Tolkien afterlife.
Well, I actually asked somebody about the Prancing Pony podcast, posed a question about, so on their Questions After Nightfall, you know, how do you think that the Noldor elves were received by the rest of the elves in Valinor when they started coming back, finally, you know, sailing west and never returning?
I like to think the Vanyar were very chill about it, and they just sort of looked a little bit judgmentally out of the corner of their eye. But I think the Teleri, I think they did a slow clap, and they said, well, well, well.
Look
who's
come back
here. The prodigal son returns.
Mm-hmm. How'd you like to clean off the holes of our ships for a while?
Yeah, for 3 million years, you can polish my ship.
Or something.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to the what I think is the showpiece of the episode.
Oh, I think so, too.
The trial of Day.
Yes.
Day is held in bonds as he awaits trial by the faith, with Songbird as his co-defendant and Oceanglass as his executioner. As Sunmaster prosecutes his case and the Inheritors perform their interpretive dance routine, Day learns the Brazen Head can be awoken with a melody. Over the course of his impassioned speech for his defense, Day reveals that Demerzel is the Daneel that the Inheritors have sought for millennia. He recognizes the melody she sang to him as a child and awakens the Brazen Head further. While Sunmaster is convinced of Daneel's existence as Demerzel, he proceeds in ordering Day's execution. The episode ends with Day falling toward a pit of man-eating bacteria.
Yum, yum, yum.
Delicious, right?
Day it's soup. Interesting. Yeah, Day soup. I'm not sure that he was trying to defend himself. I think it was more trying to throw himself on the mercy of the court. And at the same time say, look, I have this knowledge that you want.
Well, that's a defense strategy, isn't it? That's all I'd say. I do think he cares about his life a little bit here.
Well, yes, absolutely. But I also think it's a catharsis moment, which is why I've characterized this as classic Greek tragedy. Greek sacred drama, actually. The tragedy was the sacred drama form in which... It is intended to produce a catharsis in the audience.
That's really interesting, thinking about the interpretive dance as the chorus, right? As the group
Absolutely.
Chorus.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. From the very beginning, when I first saw that round platform spotlighted in the darkness, my first thought was, oh, are we getting theater in the round now? And it just kind of all mushroomed from there, and I thought, yeah, we sure are.
Look, the community theater scene on Mycogen is really, really strong.
Well, it had these elements of the ancient Greek drama played out in a massive Colosseum-like structure surrounded by all these people to provide witness, guided by an ancient Egyptian priest.
Whose voice still does not match his body.
No, it does not. It does not.
They should have grayed his hair at least. You know what I mean?
I do. I really do. It's a very odd choice. And well, maybe it's meant to imply that he's constantly dying it, you know? I don't know. Maybe.
Not that I think he did a bad job. I was actually kind of annoyed. I was annoyed by his shtick at first, and then I realized what it was, that it was theater the whole time. And I went, Okay, I'm in on this now.
If that was the whole thing from his first appearance in Songbird and Ocean Glass's house,
right,
was utterly theatrical and designed to be theatrical, and of course work on a drug-addled mind on top of that. But
right, well, we'll know, go I, on with your process here.
Well, I love the way that the Mycogen spectators, they were the Roman Colosseum spectators, and they were giving him the Mycogen version of thumbs down, but definitely being cheerled by Sunmaster. I would not be surprised if we have some listeners say they thought it was kind of hokey.
I thought so at first, and then I went, you know, I actually think that this is the point, right? It should be a little hokey.
Yes, because it's very high drama, it's very hieratic, and it is ritual to the max. And these are all things that I think we're not accustomed to seeing in most science fiction. I didn't understand why Sunmaster thinks that Songbird was also culpable in some fashion.
I thought it was she exposed them by doing
this. She was the one, it's because of her that they got there, but did she just up one day and say, yeah, I'm going to go to the Gossamer Court and see if I get picked?
I think she was there to gain intel. She was not supposed to reveal the existence of the inheritors, right? And that's what she did by doing the hand symbol.
Right. And you could also argue conversely that Day was not supposed to reveal the information that Demerzel is a robot, or she never would have given the hand symbol.
Sure, and that's why they're both on trial.
So, well, right? I don't know.
I do understand why she's on trial. I don't agree with it, but I think that's the logic, is you're the one who put the bait out for this emperor to come down here.
Whether or not she chose to, I think, is important to remember.
But she did, right? I mean, she chose to do that symbol. I think that's what they're saying you're culpable for.
Oh, she chose to do the symbol.
That's what
Okay. All right. I thought, you know, she certainly didn't want, before she entered into the whole thing, she didn't want Day to fall in love with her.
No. But I do think that she still had all of her old memories, right? She did willfully expose the inheritance, the existence of the inheritance. Not just today, but to Demerzel.
I think the whole episode was white. I don't think she remembers that anymore.
And no, I know. I'm just
who
saying.
Who would know what happened and what she didn't say? How does Sunmaster decide?
Well, he had already told them.
He saw her memories. That's what it was.
Well,
he
that, but also memories. Day had said, you did this symbol, and now I know what's going on.
Okay.
He came in yelling about the inheritance, right?
No, okay. Fair point. And of course, initially, you know, this iteration of Cleon, the 24th iteration, is pushing against the notion that he is culpable in this in any way. He still is part of this dynasty that did all these horrible things. And Songbird's advice today is keep your mouth shut and maybe we'll survive this. But alas, Day has really been tractable. And he tries to explain, I'm not the Cleon you're looking for, but he's told, nonetheless, you had a role in all of this. But it's when the Brazen Head starts to try and sing Demerzel's lullaby. And suddenly I thought back to what she said. Well, they actually show us her saying, you know, they could link up with fellow robots in something called the Clasp. And right. I think that's what this represents. I
mean, that a handshake can refer to machines understanding that they're working together, right? Like linking up. Mm-hmm, because it says, you know, handshake initiated, I think that's what the robot said. And
that, I don't remember.
And you, that I'm is sure what they're trying to do, right? They're trying to sort of say, hey, I'm here, we're working together here.
Yes, yes. You know, am I the only one left sending out, you know, hoping right. somebody will respond?
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
And Day does respond.
Right.
And because his memory has been stimulated by his recent drug trip into his own past, he can eventually sing the whole song, you know, the call and response or whatever it is.
Well, I think that Demerzel even still hums it sometimes because doesn't she do it this episode? In a separate scene, I don't recall which scene, but she hummed that in this episode, maybe when she was decanting the Kleons.
Could be, or going to decant the Kleons. I don't think she actually
gets pre-decanting.
Right. She's getting herself all ginned up song. And ready to go. right. This is the locker room song. But I really do love the way Day's oratory rises to match his setting. And he finally sees and says, we all tell ourselves stories to make sense of the tiny roles we play. I know I have. You are right to put me on trial. It is my place to atone. My destiny has enslaved a robot.
Dynasty,
excuse me.
You wrote it right. That's why I was correcting.
Thank you. And thinking back upon his utter cruelty and scorn of Demerzel in the previous episodes of the season, and suddenly he recognizes this. It's really poignant to me. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that his dynasty has twisted Demerzel into the monster that they themselves are.
Which is really interesting, right? Because the moral of last season is that Demerzel is the real Empress and that the Kleon clones are really just tools to have the dynasty continue in name.
Well, and who turned her into that in the first place?
Is the first Kleon. The only real Kleon was the first Kleon, right?
Exactly.
And then Demerzel was really the Empress. But the question is it just one way, or did the Kleons also turn her into a monster the same way that she turned them into what they were?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Kleon the First turned it into this thing.
Yeah.
Whose imperative was to preserve them at all costs.
See, I thought that you meant the current, you know, the generations of Kleons forged her into this monster.
Well, right. I think Day means that as well. And They continue the initial factor that started it all off.
Yeah.
In this degradation of a robot.
Right.
The sacrilege, as Songbird calls it, a violation. She had another word, which is not coming to mind, but that was last episode.
So. Heresy, perhaps.
That was the word, I think. Anyway. Yeah, so it turns out to be Sunmaster who's pronouncing the guilty verdict. I thought that Sea Glass was supposed to be the judge. I guess she was.
Ocean Glass was the executioner. I think Sunmaster was both prosecutor and judge.
Oh, you think?
And
witness.
Maybe a bit of a conflict of interest there. But yeah.
Ever so slightly, just a titch. Yeah. And of course, you know, Day might have swayed the day if he. Oh, sorry, that was a bad one. He might have saved himself if he hadn't reverted to his usual F you when Sunmaster tries to say, it's all lies, it's all been. And that,
I don't think he was ever walking out of there alive, right?
Oh, I don't think so either.
Well, you know what I mean? Without getting dropped into the vicious man-eating lion pit, no.
you mean the sacrifice? You
know, yeah, I think that he was always going to drop down there. Again, no body, no death. I am doubtful that this Day just died and his story's over right there. Yeah. I will say, please stop doing that. Like, let's not have the fake cliffhangers multiple times in a season.
It's beginning to get old, I have to say. You're right about that.
How many people can almost die and then not? And then, you know, it's don't do that. Don't do that. People have to die for your, or rather, if you're going to suggest that a person is dying, sometimes it has to be true, or the story will become meaningless.
And death will become meaningless.
Right. Right.
You know, even more.
And that's what happened in late Game of Thrones. Like, early Game of Thrones was like, oh, you're willing to kill off main characters here. And late Game of Thrones was like, we have resurrected the character an episode later.
Yeah. Well, and you're constantly, well, I shouldn't say that, but I mean, I often hear you instancing Oh, I can't remember. I think it was one of the zombie episodes or the...
The Last of Us?
Episode. Last of Us, where the guy crawls out from underneath the dumpster or something and is still alive, even though we thought he was dead.
Oh, no, no. That's The Walking Dead, actually. And
Walking Dead.
I don't really watch The Walking Dead. David will talk about that.
David will talk about that. Okay. Though. All right.
I'm aware, though, because that is now a cultural phenomenon. Like, that's in the language of critique now. Of like, all right, we crawled out of the dumpster now.
It's like jumping the shark.
Right. It just becomes climbing out of the dumpster now is mm-hmm. part of the lingo.
Yep. I thought it was a very nice echo of the imperial gesture that Sun Master uses to drop Day from the dais into a very deep and dark pit of hungry sacrifice for remediation, which is otherwise known as composting.
Yeah. Well, remediation. He calls it the fist. It doesn't sound too bad, does it?
Well, I mean, it could have some possible positive outcomes, but instead of holding up two fingers and twisting the hand, he holds up the fist and twists the hand. So,
And the two fingers being part of the inheritance, right?
Oh, interesting. But it's the Empire that holds up the two fingers.
Right. So where did that come from?
Chicken and egg here, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I was able to let the drama of the presentation, you know, theatricals, say, okay, this is good, this is cool. The evocation of all, again, those ancient earth practices, still showing up again and again. And it's hard to say. You're probably right that he wasn't going to get out of there anyway, but no. You never know.
I really am very doubtful that he was ever leaving that place.
Yeah.
I don't think he's dead. I have been faked out too many times to believe that without seeing the body.
That's the problem with doing it too many times, isn't it? After a while, you just don't believe it anymore.
It's going to be like his nanites reawaken. No, it's, I don't know. He did. Yeah. We watched him remove them. So if that happens, I'll be really upset.
Right. Which leads me to one of the reflections that I had, that throughout the past few episodes, Day has been stripping himself and been diminished from all vestiges of Empire, much like the Triple Throne itself has been diminished. He abandoned the Middle Throne and he's growing his hair and gives up his authority for, you know, drug-induced happiness. He masks himself as a Clavager. He takes off his aura bracelets. He removes his nanites. He takes off his imperial clothing and disguises himself, dresses hippie style. And now all of his attempts at disguising his persona and from everybody, including himself, have all been stripped away. And he's faced with the simple truth of, yeah, we emperors have created a monster in our own image. And it's not a pretty image. And I really was reminded of the concept of descent and return, which Joseph Campbell identifies in The Hero's Journey. And then at one particular point, there's the falling into the pit. So, you know, make of that what you will. The hero does survive that. But it's also a familiar pattern from a lot of the world's savior stories, you know, that get stripped down to your essence and then go through some kind of death, purging, descent into darkness, whatever. So another reason for me to suspect that, you know, we haven't seen the last of Day at this point.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, I know that you have a section on, you know, corrections, reflections, speculations. Why don't we turn to that next?
Yeah, so I was able to finally confirm that this is Sun Master 18. I was a little confused about the numbering system there. And I did also rewatch one more time and saw that you were absolutely right. John Beta was put in the escape pod the first time and then taken out. And
I'm always right, Marilyn.
Except when
I'm
you're
just
not.
Kidding. I'm just kidding. Right in. Listen, if you got corrections, right in. Empire@thelorehounds.com.
Yeah. And I still think it was on Maggie's orders that they extracted Beta without just knocking her off.
Could be. He does seem to like her. And her pet.
He sure does. Her and her pet. Yeah, so I have now discovered through reading the prequel volumes that the word Mentalex is Asimov's own.
Oh, is it? So
it was not invented by showrunners.
I thought that was a show thing because...
It is not a show thing.
They're just called psychologists in the original trilogy of Foundation.
That's right. But in the prequels, Seldon talks about mentalics.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So, that's good.
So there you go. Getting back to the Harry could kill the mule and that he chooses not to. He's not the one who's ensuring that the plan works. He is the one who is there to reassure Foundation after a crisis that this is all part of psychohistory, and sometimes he makes comments upon what's coming next. And it also feels a little bit like the whole God, Harry, psychohistory helps those who help themselves concept. And a lot of contemporary theology now, which set aside the notion of, you know, God comes to save the day for those who are faithful and pray and do all the right things, to God walks beside the people in the midst of their struggles and pain. So, granted, Harry's not really doing that part of it, but this interesting tension between Harry Seldon save us and Harry Seldon helps those who help themselves. And we saw that set up in the very first season.
Yeah, we did.
In fact, I think it was your favorite character who said self helps those who help themselves.
Oh, my favorite character, Salver Hardin.
Yeah.
I think I just disliked the dialogue that they were giving her. I don't even think I had a problem with the actor. It was just like every other time was like, I don't know. I don't love even in this episode, Day going, fuck you. Like, it always takes me out of sci-fi when you have like deep sci-fi like this.
Me too.
When you have like current day profanity. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I absolutely do know what you mean, John. It's jarring. It's wait a minute.
It's too here, right? I want to watch something removed.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I suppose, well, you know, you could do it in such a way that if you wanted to use something other than the F word,
Yeah, I mean, plenty of
in
books.
In context, it could still be very clear that that's exactly what they meant.
Plenty of different universes will, you know, fictional universes will create their own curse words, right? And I think that makes sense. I think it makes it feel a little bit more immersive, in my opinion.
Definitely.
I know people were, like, sick of hearing us complain about it last season, though, so I won't go on about it.
And getting back to this whole question of, you know, how culpable was Songbird in eventually winding up with having an emperor? Because she says to Oceanglass at one point, it was not supposed to work this way. There wasn't supposed to be an effing empire sitting in our living room. So,
right.
Which leads me back to the whole question of, did somebody suspect somehow, for some reason, that Demerzel was a robot, and so Songbird entered the Gossamer Court as a means of...
I have no idea. Like, what was the endgame?
Finding out if this is true, and possibly even contesting the leadership of the Sunmaster. I get the feeling that neither Songbird nor Oceanglass like Sunmaster very much, but recognize that they really have to, you know, accept his authority and follow along with what he wouldn't want to have happen for the time being. But I'm not sure either of them are particularly fond of the guy. Or maybe that's just me, you know.
No, I think they fear him more than anything.
I also wonder if they could find a functioning robot and present that robot to the Mycogenians, they would no longer have to follow the Sunmaster. And he tells Day that himself before dropping him in the saprophytic pit.
I mean, how many people have clung to power when they shouldn't, right? Because they're like, I'd rather hold on to my power than have the truth come out.
Well, it's, again, to use the religious analogy, it's kind of like having a millennia sort of religion that says, oh, someday our deity, whatever, will return. And then the leaders find out, oh, by the way, here they are. They've returned. And like,
didn't think that was part
of the program.
you don't think that certain mainstream religions would probably be very against the teachings of their own? All right, let's not get into it.
It's just interesting to ponder, you know, again, like how many emperors gave up power.
I know.
When it was said and done.
It's tough. So. It's tough. I mean, that's the story of the Pharisees in the Bible, right? That is what Jesus says, right? He says, you are more concerned about, you know, about the ritual than you are concerned about the actual teachings. Right. And that, you know, there's a lot of debate over whether that was a valid criticism of the people at that time, or if that was perhaps something inserted a little bit later because of certain groups having a little bias. So let's just say, I'm not saying this was a literal thing that happened, but I'm just saying that this is a trope that we see.
Oh, yeah.
Is people it's clinging to power more than they are truly dedicated to the faith.
It is human nature.
Right. Yep. Well, my God, we've got plenty of stuff this episode and plenty of stuff next episode.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Just so many
loose threads now, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm excited to watch the next episode, and I know our listeners probably are too.
Well, I know I am.
Yeah. So, all right. So, listen, if you are a book reader or you don't care about spoilers, we'll talk very briefly after the credits about spoilers. But for now, let me just do a quick closing of the episode. We have a bunch of affiliate podcasts. Radioactive Ramblings is doing their Fallout lore, and they are getting prepped for Fallout Season 2 in December. Then we have Nevermind the Music on their second season now, doing a ton of, or are they about to start their second season? I didn't check which season they're on. Oh my God. I'm sorry, Mark and Nicole. I'm going to discover what season you're on if you've transitioned to season 2 yet by the time we get to the next podcast. But go listen to them. Go listen to them. They're doing a lot of great stuff every single week on music and psychology.
Yeah, Properly Howard, listen to their back catalog. What's wrong with that?
Oh, they've got an episode a week for the last year. So, I mean, plenty of stuff to listen to. And Properly Howard is going forward with their, I think, wrapping up, actually, their Bacon Wrapped season. Perfect to wrap up with Kevin Bacon.
I see what you did there.
Draft of movies, and they just have a good time with that. Wolf Shift Dust and the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast are Alicia's podcasts. She's doing on Wolf Shift Dust, and she's going forward with Star Wars on the Star Wars feed. So go check all those out. I know you like Star Wars if you're watching Foundation. Probably a few people don't, but whatever. Point is, go listen to it anyway, because it's good content.
It is.
And you definitely like Dune. I mean, Dune is even closer to Foundation than Star Wars is.
Yeah, I would say so.
So, and then your podcast, Marilyn, if you want more of your voice, you can go listen to the back catalog of Rings and Rituals while you wait for your coverage of season 2 of Rings of Power.
Yes, I already thought of sort of a parallel thing between Foundation and Rings of Power concerning this whole question of how you depict the ability to move somebody emotionally. Or
yeah, that's interesting.
What devices and so forth are used.
Where's the Visi Sonar in Rings of Power?
Well, I was thinking more specifically of you know, healing types of things, but it still is a sort of a, yeah. Anyway, enough said. I might not ever actually come out recording that, so who knows?
Okay.
Nobody hold me to it. We'll see what happens when I get there.
Well, tonight, all we have left to do, besides our spoiler after the credits, don't worry, we're still doing that. Is thank people, our Discord server boosters, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, Doove71, Athena A, Lestu, Nancy M, Ghost of Partition, Radioactive Richard, and Adrian. Thank you, Adrian. We put out a call, I think on Second Breakfast that we needed another server boost, and Adrian did a couple server boosts. So thank you for pulling us back up so we could keep our fancy banner and everything. And our lore masters, Samartian, Michael G, Michelle E, Brian P, SC, Peter OH, Adam S, Nancy M, Doove71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Matthew M, Sarah M, Andra B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Sub Zero, Aaron K, Dally V, Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Lestu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Neil F, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, Julia F, Kali S, Ilmar L, /Tim, Paul K, Bobby C, Jessica H, Red Zippy, and Adrian. Thanks, everyone, for all your support.
Thank you, friends.
Everyone, join us next week for the penultimate episode of Foundation. And stick around.
Can you believe it?
Stick around after the credits if you want spoilers.
Yes.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening. All right, Marilyn. Big clue in the scene I titled, what did I title it?
Something captives. About sickbay.
Yeah, captives.
Captives, that's right.
So, to me, the fact that the mule immediately listened to Beta is, hold on. I just want to say, full spoilers on the Foundation books before anybody gets mad.
Yes.
The fact that the mule listened to Beta, I think that clearly shows Magnifico is the mule and has put something into, put a command on his puppet mule to listen to whatever Beta says. And
whatever Beta and, says goes.
Right, right.
Yeah, and while she was being scrambled by the null field, I wonder if we're supposed to come away wondering if certain aspects of her mind and maybe even certain powers are being scrambled too. I hope they're not going in that direction. It seems a bit, I don't know.
I don't think she's a mentalic. No, I think this is just the mule, the real mule put into the fake mule's head, whatever she wants, get it for her.
Right, right, right.
Because he's in like a trance, the music is building, and then she goes, I think you should leave, and it just stops.
Right.
And he immediately stops, doesn't question her at all. I do think that is, you know, a clear conditioning here.
And you'll note, we still haven't seen Maggie in this episode, too. So that's two in a row. We haven't
seen
Maggie at all.
That's right. We haven't seen him. Now, I did notice that the music I've been listening for, the music is not happening through all of those scenes. But also, I don't know if the mule is actually doing anything in these scenes, even the fake mule, because he doesn't actually, in none of these scenes do we see the fake mule actually controlling anybody, right? Even when you see the only time we see the fake mule succeed in that is in the flashback, which could be total fiction.
Right, right. You know, which, how much of it is true?
Right.
As Harry said, I wonder too, if they're presenting it in such a way that the mule has this capacity, you know, with one or two people at a time kind of thing. But Magnifico's music magnifies it so that it magnify so that it can then spread out to, you know, large numbers of people. So it was Maggie playing the song to all of the military heads of the Foundation that made it very easy for the mule when he arrived to say, okay, start killing each other. Bink. When Maggie was actually nowhere near him at that point. Right?
Right. No, so, yeah.
So, some kind of, you know, prepping them up, putting some kind of a software coding in there that gets triggered as soon as...
Yeah, it could anyway. Be. It could be. I do think that Magnifico is preconditioning people. And right. then the mule gets to snap his fingers and it happens.
Right, right, right.
Anyway, I'm pretty on board. I think the biggest thing that is the clue that he's not, that this mule is the real mule, is just that sometimes we have seen him do his little camera focus thing, like the effect of the mind control happens when only he's on screen. But I don't think we've ever seen it be successful when he does it, except in the flashback.
That's an interesting question.
So I think it's a red herring. Maybe he thinks he's doing something, but he's not doing it.
You may be right. I don't know. Waffo, I guess. It's another Waffo.
Yeah. That's all I have for this episode. How about you?
Well, there was the thing I was going to say about one of the characteristics
Daniil.
In the prequels is that he is able to influence human emotion.
Right.
Which is an interesting sort of twist. And so now I'm back to, well, to what extent might Demerzel be able to do that? We don't see her doing anything like that thus far. Unless she's, you know, putting the soothings on, which is from a different galaxy altogether, on, you know, the young dawns when they're unhappy or upset or whatever.
But yeah, or if that chip is inhibiting it, right? Who knows?
Well, that's true. I mean, if she started out initially with, you know, that sort of ability to enter into human emotions and tweak them slightly.
What if she manipulated the first Cleon to have sympathy for her? I don't think she...
That could well be.
But it backfired, right? She made him have sympathy for her? And he's like, okay, I have sympathy for you. Here's a collar.
Right. And having put that collar on, she no longer has that capacity.
Right.
To emotionally influence anyone or anything.
Right. So. I could see that being a little twist there. Like she put her own leash on.
Well, I don't think she intended it.
Accidentally, really. I mean,
it was just that, you know, 3-second moment when she was just finally all reassembled and there, and he was behind her doing something to say, okay, I'm reinitiating your programming, and boom, she suddenly, what have you done? What did you do? You know, and now the love the Cleon law has superseded the Zeroeth law and presented her with, you know, several hundred years of existential conflict.
Oh boy, poor Demerzel. Poor Daniil.
Yeah, I really like how much more sympathy one has for her at the end of this episode than I think maybe in past ones. Or, I mean, it's been building all along, hasn't it?
Yeah, I had a lot of sympathy for her in season two when we saw her origin story, honestly.
Yeah. No, that was very good, very dramatic.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Very cool.
Hard to believe there's only two more. Is number 10 going to be a double episode? Do we hear something?
I don't know about that. I have no idea. I don't even think we have the screener access yet at the time that we're recording this.
Well, they're telling us the title of it now, which they hadn't been before. So right. I don't know how much that means.
Who knows?
I'm not going to try because I don't want to watch it until after we've watched and recorded for episode 9.
Right.
Which will be next week.
All right. Well, everyone join us next week for the pre-finale, the penultimate episode, I don't know what to call it anymore, of Foundation Season 3. We will see you then.
Yes. Bye-bye.